Hello and welcome to Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. It's March 27th, 2016. It was on this day in 1990 that the United States began broadcasting TV Marti to Cuba. Now, here's what's ahead on today's program. Pete Musto is here with part two of his report on the challenges part-time college teachers face. They want full-time jobs, but there aren't many openings anymore. Then Ana Mateo will be with us, as she is every Sunday, with Words and Their Stories. This week, she tells us how Americans describe people who can do many things. Some of the ways we talk about these multi-talented people include calling them jack of all trades or a Renaissance person. And as we always do on the Sunday edition of Learning English Weekend, we will present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, we take you back to 1917. We will tell you the story of Europe at war and the entrance of hundreds of thousands of American troops onto the European battlefields. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the voice of America. Last week on the program, we brought you part one of higher education correspondent Pete Musto's report on the difficulties college teachers are having finding full-time work. Pete reported on the disappearance of tenured or permanent professorships. In 1969, 80% of faculty positions in the United States were tenured, or gave people a chance to get tenure. Now, less than 30% are. Pete continues his report now on the challenges of teaching college part-time.
David Chatfield teaches graphic design at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania and Cumberland County College in New Jersey. He also helps organize faculty for the American Federation of Teachers, or AFT. The AFT is a union that represents teachers across the country. Chatfield says being a part-time professor at more than one school is not only difficult financially, it also divides his attention and prevents him from having a relationship with his students.
I'm just a body that the administration puts in front of a class because they need to fill the class, and that's about it. So I don't feel like they value me because I don't have an office. I don't get paid for any extra stuff that I do for my students outside of class.
Chatfield adds that his schools limit the amount he can teach so they can legally avoid giving him benefits. He also said other part-time faculty he has met through working with the AFT are tired.
You'll get exhausted from commuting between several schools and teaching more than what is normally expected of a college professor.
The University of California, Berkeley Labor Center is an organization that studies labor issues. A 2015 Labor Center report said 25% of part-time faculty across the country use some form of public assistance program. These programs help people with little money pay for basic needs like food and health care. Faculty in the California State University, or CSU, system are now fighting their administration for greater pay. There are 23 campuses and 25,000 teaching faculty in this system. About 60% of CSU faculty are temporary. The California Faculty Association, or CFA, is the union that represents a majority of the CSU faculty. The CFA is asking for a 5% pay increase for all faculty. If the administration does not agree, the CFA says its members will strike on April 13th. Jennifer Egan is a professor of philosophy at California State University at East Bay. She is also the president of the CFA. Egan says the CSU administration is trying to cut costs by hiring more temporary workers. The CSU reports the average pay for full-time faculty is $96,000 per year. The CFA reports the average temporary faculty member earns $28,000 per year. Tony Mall is the director of public affairs for the CSU system. She says the system only has enough money to provide a 2% pay increase. She also notes the administration takes great efforts to care for its teachers. For example, faculty only need to teach 2 classes for them and their families to receive benefits. But, Mall says, the administration has many priorities it must consider.
These are essentially fixed costs, and we have other fixed costs such as infrastructure, technology, building and equipment.
Mall adds, the CSU budget is $135 million below what she calls pre-recession levels. The U.S. economy went through a recession from 2007 to 2012. In January, California Governor Jerry Brown promised $152 million for the CSU system in 2016. But Mall says that does not solve their current problems. Egan argues that the problem of underpaying faculty has existed for 10 years. The administration gave the faculty a 1.34% pay increase in 2013 and a 1.6% increase in 2014. But Egan says this does not meet the rising cost of living. Administrators are moving away from education and towards a corporate model, Egan says.
I think it is a matter of choosing what you want to prioritize. Do you want to prioritize the experience of students and who works with students on a day-to-day basis? Or do you want to prioritize executives and other priorities that are further away from student experience? It really is a choice that are made by managers, so maybe their lack of experience in the classroom recently is influencing their decision.
I'm Pete Musto.
Thanks, Pete. Now, if it's Sunday, it means Ana Mateo is here with one of our most popular programs.
Hello, and welcome to Words and Their Stories. Each week, we report on words and expressions commonly used in American English. Today, we talk about people who can do many things. Someone with many abilities often is called a jack of all trades, or a Renaissance person. A jack of all trades is a person who can do many different jobs. Jack is an old word for worker, and a trade is a kind of job or skill. A Renaissance man or a Renaissance woman is a little different. This expression deals with a person's education and knowledge, not so much with his or her skills. The word Renaissance comes from Old French and means rebirth. The Renaissance is a period of European history that began in the 14th century. It's a time when Europe began to awaken from the long period known as the Middle Ages. Classical learning from ancient Greece and Rome was reborn in many parts of Europe. During the Renaissance, people became more interested in learning and educating themselves. The word Renaissance can describe anything that is experiencing a rebirth. Arts, crafts, and musical styles often undergo a renaissance. For example, you might say that currently in the U.S., playing the ukulele is experiencing a renaissance. Many people are learning to play this small Hawaiian guitar. Used in this way, Renaissance is not capitalized. In the U.S., the Harlem Renaissance is an African-American cultural movement of the 1920s and 1930s. Named after a neighborhood of New York City, this Renaissance celebrated African-American culture, traditions, and ways of life. However, when talking about people, the term Renaissance man or woman refers to a person who is talented in many areas, especially the arts and sciences. Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, and Benjamin Franklin are often called Renaissance men. Everyone knows about these guys. The names of Renaissance women in history may be less well known. In the past, it wasn't as easy for women to get a formal education, even during the Awakening. Also, women were often too busy at home to study up on their sciences. But some women did find time. A German woman named Maria Sibylla Marion was a Renaissance woman. She spent her life investigating and drawing nature. After her husband died, she and her daughters traveled to Paramaribo, the capital of Suriname. For 2 years, they observed insects, birds, reptiles, and amphibians. Her book, titled The Metamorphosis of the Insects of Suriname, showed Europeans for the first time the great diversity of the South American rainforest. A more recent example of a Renaissance woman is the Austrian Hedy Lamarr. During the 1930s and 1940s, Lamarr was one of Hollywood's biggest movie stars. She was also an inventor. During the Second World War, she created a way to protect radio communications from enemy troops. Her method switched radio frequencies in a pre-programmed pattern. While the Navy did not use the technology, other inventors built upon her idea. Eventually, the U.S. government did use frequency hopping, as do many telecommunications companies today. Lamarr once said she hated being known for her beauty and not her mind, a problem Renaissance men like Da Vinci and Franklin most likely did not have to face. I'm Anna Mateo.
Thanks, Anna. Now, as we do every Sunday, we present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, Larry West and Tony Riggs continue the story of President Woodrow Wilson and the growing involvement of American troops in the battles in Europe during World War I.
In 1917, Europe was at war. It was the conflict known as World War I. After 3 years of fighting, Europe's lands were filled with the sights and sounds of death. But still, the armies of the Allies and the Central Powers continued to fight. The United States had tried to keep out of the European conflict. It declared its neutrality. In the end, however, neutrality was impossible. Germany was facing starvation because of a British naval blockade. To break the blockade, German submarines attacked any ship that sailed to Europe. That included ships from neutral nations like the United States. The German submarines sank several American ships. Many innocent people were killed.
German submarine attacks finally forced the United States into the war. It joined the Allies, Britain, France, and Russia. Like most Americans, President Wilson did not want war, but he had no choice. Sadly, he asked Congress for a declaration of war. Congress approved the declaration on April 6, 1917. It was not long before American soldiers reached the European continent. They marched in a parade through the streets of Paris. The people of France gave them a wild welcome. They cheered the young Americans. They threw flowers at the soldiers and kissed them.
The Americans marched to the burial place of the Marquis de Lafayette. Lafayette was the French military leader who had come to America's aid during its war of independence from Britain. The United States wanted to repay France for its help more than 100 years earlier. An American army officer made a speech at the tomb. He said, "Lafayette, we are here."
And so the Americans were there. They were ready to fight in the bloodiest war the world had ever known. Week by week, more American troops arrived. By October 1917, the American army in Europe totaled 100,000 men. The leader of that army was General John J. Pershing. Pershing's forces were not sent directly into battle. Instead, they spent time training, building bases, and preparing supplies. Then, a small group was sent to the border between Switzerland and Germany. The Americans fought a short but bitter battle there against German forces. The Germans knew the American soldiers had not fought before. They tried to frighten the Americans by waving their knives and guns in a fierce attack. The Americans surprised the Germans. They stood and fought back successfully.
Full American participation in the fighting did not come for several months. It came only after another event took place. That event changed the war and the history of the 20th century. It was the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. Its leader was Vladimir Lenin. The Russian Revolution began in the spring of 1917. The people of that country were tired of fighting Germany, and they were tired of their ruler, Tsar Nicholas. The Tsar was overthrown. A temporary government was established. It was headed by Alexander Kerensky. President Woodrow Wilson sent a team of American officials to Russia to help Kerensky's new government. The officials urged Russia to remain in the war.
Under Kerensky, Russia did keep fighting, but it continued to suffer terrible losses. Many Russians demanded an end to the war. Lenin saw this opposition as a way to gain control of the government. So he went to the city of Petrograd. There, he led the opposition to the war and to Kerensky. Night after night, he spoke to big crowds. "What do you get from war?" he shouted. "Only wounds, hunger, and death." Lenin promised peace under Bolshevik communism. Within a few months, he won control of the Petrograd Soviet. That was an organization of workers and soldiers. Another Bolshevik communist, Leon Trotsky, controlled the Soviet in Moscow.
Kerensky's government continued to do badly in the war. More and more Russian soldiers lost hope. Many fled the army. Others stayed, but they refused to fight. The end came in November 1917. Soldiers in Petrograd turned against Kerensky. Lenin ordered them to rebel, and he took control of the government within 48 hours. Russia was now a communist nation. As promised, Lenin called for peace. So Russia signed its own peace treaty with Germany. The treaty forced Russia to pay a high price for its part in the war. It had to give up a third of its farmland, half of its industry, and 90% of its coal mines. It also lost a third of its population. Still, it did not have real peace with Germany.
The treaty between Russia and Germany had a powerful influence on the military situation in the rest of Europe. Now, Germany no longer had to fight an enemy on two fronts. Its eastern border was quiet suddenly. It could aim all its forces against Britain, France, and the other allies on its western border. Germany had suffered terrible losses during 4 years of war. Many of its soldiers had been killed. And many of its civilians had come close to starving because of the British naval blockade. Yet, Germany's leaders still hoped to win. They decided to launch a major attack. They knew they had to act quickly before the United States could send more troops to help the Allies.
German military leaders decided to break through the long battle line that divided most of Central Europe. They planned to strike first at the north end of the line. British troops held that area. The Germans would push the British off the continent and back across the English Channel. Then they would turn all their strength on France. When France was defeated, Germany would be victorious. The campaign opened in March 1918. German forces attacked British soldiers near Amiens, France. The Germans had 6,000 pieces of artillery. The British troops fought hard, but could not stop the Germans. They were pushed back 50 kilometers. The attack stopped for about a week.
Then the Germans struck again. This time, their target was Ypres, Belgium. The second attack was so successful, it seemed the Germans might push the British all the way back to the sea. The British commander, Field Marshal Douglas Haig, ordered his men not to withdraw. Haig said, "There is no other course open to us but to fight it out." The British fought hard and stopped the attack. Losses on both sides were extremely high. Yet the Germans continued with their plan.
Their next attack was northeast of Paris in May. This time, they broke the Allied line easily and rushed toward Paris. The German army chief, General Erich Ludendorff, tried to capture the French capital without waiting to strengthen his forces. He got close enough to shell the city. The French government prepared to flee. Allied military leaders rushed more troops to the area. The new force included 2 big groups of American Marines.
The heaviest fighting was near Paris, at a place called Belleau Wood. The American Marines were advised to prepare for a possible withdrawal. One Marine said, "Withdraw? We just got here." The Marines resisted as the Germans attacked Allied lines in Belleau Wood again and again. Then the Marines attacked the German lines. The battle for Belleau Wood lasted 3 weeks. It was the most serious German offensive of the war, an offensive the Germans lost. We will continue our story of World War I next week here on Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. You can find the entire Making of a Nation series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at learningenglish.voanews.com. Well, that's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. You can read and listen to the stories that you have heard on today's program on our website. Once again, that's learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. Next week on Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition, we'll have another in-depth report on higher education. And Anna Mateo will bring us another Words and Their Stories report. And on The Making of a Nation, we will take you back to 1918, the final year of the most terrible war the world had ever known. Jonathan Evans will be here tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English with As It Is Monday, the weekday Learning English broadcast, webcast, and podcast from The Voice of America.